It is Monday, July 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the Islamic State claims responsibility for Sunday's explosion in Ansbach, Germany.
They want there to be a backlash against the asylum seekers, the migrants that fled Syria. They want to create social and ethnic tensions in countries like Germany.
The Democratic National Convention begins in Philadelphia with an email scandal erupting. And we look at singer Selena Gomez's presence on social media. It's all ahead. The Islamic State's Amaq News Agency says the 27-year-old Syrian migrant who set off an explosion, killing himself and wounding at least a dozen people in Ansbach, Germany, was one of its soldiers. Amaq reported that an insider source said the attacker carried out the operation in response to calls to target countries of the coalition that fights Islamic State. Bavaria's top security official told reporters Monday the attacker had recorded a video on his cell phone, pledging allegiance to the leader of IS, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Joachim Herman also said bomb-making materials such as gasoline and chemicals were found in the assailant's home. Sajan Gohel is the International Security Director of the Asia-Pacific Foundation in London. I asked him how this case demonstrates the continuing evolution of IS in Western Europe.
The attack in Ansbach, Germany, may have failed, but it illustrates that ISIS is very keen on recruiting people that are currently living in the UK. And this fits into a message that its head of external operations, Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, issued prior to Ramadan, in which he basically told followers that if you cannot join us in Syria, then carry out attacks wherever you are. And that was specifically aimed at people in the West. And we have seen a whole spate of attacks now where people have claimed allegiance to ISIS, even though they may have not been directly trained by them in Raqqa, whether it's in Orlando, Ansbach, Nice. We are seeing more case studies like this.
But it seems like, at least in some cases, the sort of connection is, in some cases, rather tenuous. I mean, some of them could be seen as like a lone wolf that is just inspired by ISIS, but then others literally have had, I guess, some communications with leaders.
The parallel of whether someone has been directly trained by ISIS as opposed to somebody who has tenuous connections by simply just following and heeding the call, in many ways that is a distinction without a difference. For ISIS, it doesn't matter whether you have been formally connected to the group or whether you just buy into the ideology online. If you carry out an attack in their name, for ISIS, you are very much part of their propaganda, their goals, their agendas, and their strategies. And that is what has been so dangerous about the group, is that it is able to transmit a message which impacts on the psyche of young people across the globe. And it is now very difficult to just stop and disrupt these type of plots from happening, because very often it's just by one individual.
Well, now, this particular person had received psychiatric treatment. He apparently had tried to kill himself twice before. But he was also a Syrian. He was a migrant. And, of course, in the last, you know, recent years, there have been a number of Syrians who have migrated to Europe. And there have been concerns, security concerns, about some of them.
It is not a coincidence that this individual was an asylum seeker from Syria and claimed allegiance to ISIS. It is very deliberately mischievous and surreptitious by ISIS. They want there to be a backlash against the asylum seekers, the migrants that fled Syria. They want to create social and ethnic tensions in countries like Germany, which has taken over 1 million people from Syria. This is a very deliberate and calculated strategy for them to foment tension. It's important not to fall into that trap.
Sajan Gohel, International Security Director of the Asia-Pacific Foundation in London. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's been some of the response to this?
Well, there's been a lot of concern after this attack, as we've seen over the past few weeks when we've had these attacks it kind of follows this pattern where the news first breaks and then there's the outpouring of sympathy and then the real fear that comes, people saying, could this happen to me? Could this happen at a place where I'm having lunch or dinner or hanging out with friends? So a lot of concern about that, but also a resolve from people that we're going to keep trying to fight and prevent these things from happening. Also a lot of concern here in the U.S. for a different story in Fort Myers, Florida, where there's a shooting at a nightclub that killed at least two people, left 17 injured. Now, the one thing that a lot of people are talking about from this shooting is that one of the victims that was injured was 12 years old.
Oh.
And that have a victim that's that young really struck a lot of people. So there's a lot of outrage on social media over that and that shooting. We also have the Democrats' turn with their convention coming up here in the U.S. this starting today, and we're going to hear from our Doug Bernard a little bit later about that, but he'll get into the details. But there's an email controversy with the Democratic National Committee and some emails that were leaked by hackers. Now, this is not lost on people on social media. Hillary Clinton has had a controversy over her use of email. A lot of people saying it's, you know, goes hand in hand, and for the Democrats to have an email controversy come up right before their convention, when this is an issue that Republicans have repeatedly raised with Hillary Clinton's emails, probably not the best timing for them.
Yeah.
And finally, Yahoo, the search engine, sold to Verizon here in the U.S. for $4.8 billion. One tweet I saw said, Yahoo's had really bad luck. They had an opportunity to buy Google back in 1998 for $1 million, and they turned it down. And they had an opportunity to be bought by Microsoft for $40 billion in 2008. Well, today they're sold for $4.8 billion, so maybe not the greatest moves on Yahoo's part, but still a big payday.
Yeah, pretty.
I would take $4.8 million, absolutely.
Thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top stories trending. The United Nations warns of record level of Afghan civilian casualties. Security in the South China Sea are major issues at ASEAN foreign minister meetings in Laos. China's former top general has been sentenced to life in prison, and two people are killed in a shooting at a U.S. nightclub. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Scientists working with what has been purported to be the world's most sensitive dark matter detector say that despite spending 20 months looking for the mysterious stuff, they have not been able to detect even a single trace of it. The large underground xenon dark matter experiment was conducted at the Sanford Underground Research Facilities, located beneath about 1.6 kilometers of earth and rock in the Black Hills of South Dakota. The Lux scientists say their detector was so sensitive that if any dark matter particles had actually interacted with their device, it would have certainly pointed them out. The researchers say their experiment gathered and then later analyzed nearly 500 terabytes worth of data. Findings from the Lux experiment will be used to help those conducted in the future, such as the Lux Zeppelin experiment, which is expected to continue the search for dark matter in 2020. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the International Olympic Committee decides not to issue a total ban on Russian athletes at the Rio Olympics. Well, the head of the U.S. Democratic Party resigned Sunday on the eve of the party's national convention, which is set to affirm former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton as its 2016 presidential nominee. The head of the DNC, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, quit the post amid a furor over leaked emails that show party leaders mocked and criticized the upstart campaign of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. I'm joined now by International Edition's Doug Bernard, who is at the convention in Philadelphia. Well, so, Doug, this whole instance involving Debbie Wasserman Schultz has sort of, you know, got the convention, I think we can say, off to a bit of a rocky start.
Oh, I think that's fair to say. You know, they say that Philadelphia is the city of brotherly love. And, you know, Democrats were really hoping that this week there would be a whole lot more brotherly love on display than among Republicans last week in Cleveland. However, this whole email scandal, and it really is now at the level of a scandal, has really put a damper on things. in short, what happened is, you know, the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, really is supposed to be something of a fair arbiter in all of the primaries. They're supposed to, you know, kind of equally guard and protect all of the candidates, potential nominees, and that sort of thing. But what these emails make very clear is that some in the DNC, some in your leadership position, really had their thumb on the scale in support of Secretary Clinton and against Senator Sanders. So this really does lend credence to those charges that, you know, you've been hearing among some of Sanders supporters that, you know, this whole system was rigged, it was, you know, set from the outset. Well, now it looks like that they're at least, you know, armed for that argument. And some of them are ready to have a fight.
And we should note that, you know, Wasserman Schultz has been quite a prominent, very high visible Democrat. She is a big fundraiser for the party. She would often be on a lot of television news shows. Very much she was kind of looked on, I've heard, as sort of the attack dog against the Republicans.
Right. Yeah, you know, but it has not really been a good year for her at all. And Donald Trump is famous for wanting to build a wall with Mexico. I think a lot of Democrats have been wanting to build a wall around Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Well, they don't have to worry about that now. Once this convention is done, she is out of here. We don't even know if she's going to gavel it in or not. She is that unpopular a figure right now. So her departure, it may help soothe some feelings, some of those bitter feelings, but it really doesn't answer the basic questions as to whether the DNC was really playing fair for all the candidates, particularly Secretary Clinton and Senator Sanders, or whether they, you know, were really kind of trying to game the system.
Well, now, looking ahead, I believe that the convention formally opens this afternoon, and I believe one of the leading speakers tonight will be Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, well, so now, you're right, the convention gavels in at 4, and there'll be the kind of standard prayers and opening speeches and that kind of thing later today. It really gets going. Now, I was just looking over the schedule now, and again, these are always subject to change. Senator Warren isn't listed today, but of course, that's not to say that she won't be speaking today. Clearly, the two highlight speakers, however, today, who are on the schedule are Senator Bernie Sanders, who is hoped and expected to give a speech, even in the light of all these emails, that is fully in support, endorsing Secretary Clinton, urging his supporters to go back her. And then it's going to wrap up later today with an address by Michelle Obama, who is a very, very popular figure among Democrats. So they're clearly, I think, the Democratic, at least so far, they're really trying to the first night is usually a speak to the base night anyway. So if, in fact, Senator Warren does speak tonight, that would not surprise me at all. She is a darling among the progressives and the more liberal set at this convention. So it's really going to be a night to try and speak to the base and get everybody on the same page.
All right. Well, thanks very much. That's International Edition's Doug Bernard reporting from Philadelphia at the Democratic Convention. In other news, the International Olympic Committee has decided not to issue a total ban on Russian athletic competition in the Rio Olympic Games, despite last week's report by the World Anti-Doping Association that found evidence of state-sponsored doping by Russian athletes at the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi. But IOC President Thomas Bach said each Russian athlete cannot compete unless he or she meets strict criteria.
For instance, we decided that the presumption of innocence cannot be applied to Russian athletes. The international sports federations will carry out an individual analysis of each athlete's anti-doping record, taking into account only reliable international tests. That means Russian tests cannot be taken into consideration. Unlike any other National Olympic Committee, no Russian athlete who has ever had a doping sanction will be accepted in the Olympic Games Rio 2016, even if he or she has served the sanction. The IOC will then take the final decision based on the advice of an arbitrator of the Court of Arbitration for Sport, the highest judicial authority in sport.
Bach said the IOC sought balance between the desire and need for collective responsibility and the right to individual justice for each athlete. Ed Hula is founder and editor of the website AroundTheRings.com, a publication that follows the business and politics of the Olympic movement. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the IOC is trying to walk a fine line with one of the world's most influential sporting nations.
What they have created is a very complicated, difficult to implement procedure here that requires the 300 and something Russian athletes who are supposed to compete in Rio. They're going to have to prove themselves worthy from the drugs point of view, from the doping point of view, in order to be competing in Rio. And they've only got 12 days, a little more than a week, to get this all done. Russia is a very powerful partner of the Olympic movement. They host sports events, world championships, Winter Olympic Games, for example. The World Cup is coming up in 2018. IOC members are from Russia, an important country for sport. And that's why the IOC finds it very difficult, a bit reluctant, to just throw out the Russians entirely from the Rio Olympics.
If this had been another country, would it have been a different story?
Could have been. You know, a smaller, less politically influential country might have not been able to withstand the pressure, not been able to put pressure towards the IOC as well. You know, the Russians have Vladimir Putin. Not many other nations have that kind of head of state who has a personal relationship with the IOC president.
Well, on the face of it, the IOC seems to have delivered a fair ruling, given the fact that not all athletes necessarily are engaged in such activity. What do you make of that?
Well, that is the idea of protecting clean athletes, and it's really the right way to do it. If you're not guilty of doping, why should you be treated just like those who have? You know, what the IOC wants to be able to do is bring these clean athletes to Rio de Janeiro, all keeping out the dirty ones.
Here's a quote from the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. Many, including clean athletes and whistleblowers, have demonstrated courage and strength in confronting a culture of state-supported doping and corruption within Russia. Disappointingly, however, in response to the most important moment for clean athletes and the integrity of the games, the IOC has refused to take decisive leadership. Is that a fair statement?
That is what they want, that kind of death penalty, if you will, for a country that flagrantly violates doping laws. And the IOC just apparently doesn't want to go that far because they feel they will penalize the clean athletes. The national anti-doping organizations like the United States, Canada, around the world are definitely in favor of this strict punishment for the Russians.
Ed Hula says the National Olympic Committees of other nations and international sports federations are generally in favor of the IOC decision. This is VOA.
The U.S. presidential election takes place on November 8, 2016. VOA provides extensive coverage of this important political event. Who are the candidates and what are the issues that will determine who the next president will be? Tune in around the clock for coverage of the U.S. presidential election right here on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. Well, if you're a star, it's important to have a great social media presence. International Edition's Jim Stevenson talks with VOA's Ray McDonald, who goes right to the top with one of the best examples.
You got me sipping on something I can't compare to nothing.
We are going to be talking about Selena Gomez and her mastery of social media.
And she is all over social media. I saw her on Twitter with a picture of her fans today.
That's right. She really knows how to use social media. And, you know, Jim, you and I, we came up in the 70s and 80s where if you were a musician and you weren't on tour, You were hoping to angle for a nice fat record deal, and that would pretty much pay the bills. But as we know, today album sales are not what they used to be. The album market's pretty much cratered unless your name is Adele or Taylor Swift.
Right.
But you can still make money if you're a savvy musician and you're one of the lucky few. Now, I want to concentrate on Selena Gomez, because when it comes to personal branding, she's one of several celebrities, and they're all female, who dominate social media these days. Measurement company DeMarie Analytics just ranked the top social influencers. All of them are women, and Selena is number one. They say that Selena Gomez is worth $550,000 per post.
Wow.
When messaging across Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Selena is the most followed person on Instagram. Right now, she has more than 90 million followers. Now, the CEO of DeMarie Analytics, Frank Spatafora, says that Gomez isn't necessarily getting $500,000 to post. What she is getting is negotiated between her agents and the company she promotes. Mm-hmm. Right now, Selena Gomez has deals with Coca-Cola, Pantene Shampoo, and Kmart stores. Spatafora says one reason she's successful is that she's smart. She's very subtle about how she uses social media to promote these products. She knows that saturating her feeds with promotion could negatively impact her relationship with her fans. She doesn't want to be seen as a shill. So she has fewer contracts than some of her contemporaries. But the advertisers get more mileage out of it, mm-hmm, because Selena's fans believe she honestly likes the stuff that she's using. I mentioned that she's the number one person on Instagram. She also has 60 million likes on Facebook and 44 million Twitter followers.
Selena provides a pretty good business model here. Less is more, mm-hmm, as she is very selective about her posting, mm-hmm, and she appears very genuine when she is using these products.
That's right. Selena Gomez has always projected a very likable image. People have watched her grow up. I mean, she was a Disney star when she was a girl. The social media market is evolving. It's very turbulent. It's kind of like the Wild West. It has opportunities, but it also has huge pitfalls.
Lots of opportunities each and every week for you to listen to our Top 20 Countdown with our host, Ray McDonald.
You can hear it Thursdays on VOA 1. And you can also follow me on my Twitter feed at Ray on the Hits.
Thanks so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
And that's our show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Once the fighting ends, peace treaties are signed and armies are disbanded, the world assumes too often that life in former conflict areas will soon return to normal. But leftover landmines and unexploded munitions stand in the way of post-conflict stabilization and inhibit long-term development. They render thousands of hectares of land unusable and destabilize communities. To mitigate long-term damage and help war-ravaged communities move toward a sustainable peace, the United States has, since 1993, provided over $2.6 billion for conventional weapons destruction programs that help to safely clear landmines and explosive remnants of war, such as ammunition, artillery shells, and air-delivered bombs. Still, in many countries, landmines and unexploded ordnance can kill and maim their victims decades after the original conflict is little more than an ugly memory. Completely ridding former battlegrounds of these explosives is therefore a long-term project. This effort cannot succeed without building local expertise in partner nations and training leaders that can take control of mine clearance programs in their own countries. The Center for International Stabilization and Recovery at James Madison University in the state of Virginia has for many years conducted management training for leaders in humanitarian mine action around the world. Since 2010, the State Department's Office of Weapons Removal and Abatement has sponsored the course, which seeks to integrate the latest ideas in business management with the practical experience of mine clearance professionals. The goal is to train senior managers of national demining programs to make the programs function more effectively and efficiently. In late spring of this year, the university hosted 21 demining management professionals from Afghanistan, Colombia, Iraq, Laos, Lebanon, Libya, Palau, Senegal, Sri Lanka, Somalia, Tajikistan, Vietnam, and Yemen. They honed their technical and managerial skill, which they will now apply, improving their country's capacity to clear contaminated land. The United States is investing in mine and explosives clearance because by doing so, we not only protect civilians from explosive remnants of war, but we also enable lasting peace.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States.